This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
For this month's JodBite, the interviewer becomes the interviewee. Today I'm with Liz Guzman, now Dr. Lizette Guzman, formerly of Jodrell Bank and now working for ESO, the European Southern Observatory, in Santiago. Hi, Liz.
Hi.
So we're doing this interview by Skype, and Liz is currently working for ESO and, most interestingly, is working on the ALMA project. So as a start, Liz, could you kind of just give us a bit of a run-through of what ALMA is and what it does?
Of course. Yeah, sure. So ALMA is what stands for, the Atacama Large Millimeter and Submillimeter Array. And what it is 66 huge antennas. Well, it's actually, some of them are 12 meters and some of them are 7 meters antennas. And they are all spread in the Chagnantor Valley, which is in the Atacama Desert in Chile. And what they do is they record, or they observe all the submillimeter sky, let's say. So we use ALMA to observe submillimeter galaxies and observe carbon monoxide, so CO mainly. But you can observe tons of molecules. And people like to say that actually ALMA is observing the let's say, cold part of the universe. Because it's always, for you to detect molecules, they have to be in a cold environment, let's say. Because if it's too hot, then you dissociate the molecules. So you don't see the molecules anymore. So you detect molecules everywhere. And you also detect carbon monoxide everywhere. So you're detecting star formation and planet formation, in, as I say, in galaxies and evolved stars, pretty much everywhere in the universe. So ALMA is sort of the biggest telescope in the world that is doing this. And it's a huge project. So it's mainly three different parties, let's say. So it's the NRAO, which is in the US, and then it's ESO, which is the European Southern Observatory, and then it's Japan, the National Observatory of Japan. So there's like people from everywhere in here. And so I got a fellowship from ESO with my duties in ALMA. So I have to come up here, because I'm in ALMA right now, I have to come up here once a month to do sort of observatory duty. So either reducing data, observations, or trying to test something. So right now we're still doing a bit of commissioning, so observing new stuff, and we're still adding more new antennas, right? So every day we have new antennas that we have to add to the array. And for you to add them, you have to do tons of tests. So we have to do that, and then we have to do observations as well.
So how many antennas are currently functioning?
So up in the high side, we have 54 right now. But functioning, we have about 40.
So the total is going to be 66. So there's still another 12 that need to be sort of installed and brought up to the high side.
Yeah. Some of them are already in the high side, but they haven't been like properly sort of integrated to the array. And down in the control room, we have, I think we have around 7 antennas that we're still doing some tests and stuff. Yeah. But all of the antennas have been built. So the last one, constructed one, was delivered to us, which is like science, about 2 months ago, I think.
Nice. So just, I think, probably to clarify for our listeners, you're talking about the high site and the control room. Could you describe a little bit what the ALMA location, the ALMA complex, is like?
Yeah, sure. So it's actually pretty cool. So, right, so you're from Santiago. All of the astronomers, we sort of live in Santiago or around Santiago, let's say. And then we have to fly to Calama, which is like north. And then from Calama, we have to take a bus to San Pedro, which is pretty touristic. So maybe people have heard of San Pedro de Atacama. So you go to San Pedro, and then ALMA is about 40 minutes away from San Pedro. You're still going north of Chile. And then you get to the campsite, let's say, which this is about 2,500 meters up in sea level. So this is where you have the dorms and you have the control room. And then what we call the high site is where the antennas are, and this is at 5,000 meters. So, for example, engineer people and electronic people and sometimes software people, they have to go to the high site almost every day to check everything in the antennas and check that things are going smooth and stuff. And if everything is broken, of course, they have to go and fix it. Us, the astronomers, we don't really have to go to the high site. I've been a few times because I just want to go and see how it's like. But but we don't have to operate in the high side. We operate from the control room, which is at 2,500.
So the main thing that sets ALMA apart is essentially the number of antennas that it has, and it can get, if I understand correctly, it can get the highest resolution so far of a telescope that operates at these wavelengths.
Yeah, exactly. It's pretty impressive, to be honest. Actually, even from cycle zero, so ALMA is divided into, like, let's say different stages when you have some many antennas that you can operate, and then you call that cycle zero, let's say. And then you get up more antennas and you call that cycle one, and then more antennas and you call that cycle two, let's say. So even in cycle zero, which we only had 13 antennas, that was already like pretty high resolution, and it was sort of the level of the Hubble telescope, which is already quite high, right? After that, I mean, right now cycle one was 32 antennas, and cycle two now is 34 antennas. So the good thing of ALMA is that you have the compact array in the center, which are the 7 major antennas, and those are good to see extended emission of the objects. So imagine that you have a big dish, let's say, a very big dish that you can see a lot of stuff, like the big stuff in a galaxy. Let's say you see the spiral arms, and you see all the star formation regions around the spiral arms in the center. But the 12-meter antennas that are like spread around, they actually can see very, very like high resolution stuff of the one of the star forming region, let's say.
Right.
So you can get like the very, very high resolution stuff and also the extended emission, which is like amazing because it gives you both.
Yeah, that's the cool thing about interferometry, basically, because it sort of just depends on the baseline, on how far away two antennas are from each other, and that determines what kind of resolution you get. So if you've got a bunch of different antennas, then you can combine everything, which is pretty cool, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
As ALMA, what are the major results that ALMA has had so far? Any sort of cool pictures or new things that have made scientists sort of rethink their theories?
Yeah. It's pretty awesome. So one that I remember that it was stuck in my head, or still stuck in my head. So, you know, we have this like idea of planetary formation. So there was a bunch of group of people trying to observe a planet in the formation stages, right? So you have star, and you have a disk that they call the protoplanetary disk, and then you have a planet inside that is just forming, just at the beginning of the formation. And this is because we wanted to test all the theories of planetary formation, right? And also to understand how our solar system was formed, right? So they observed with ALMA and all these things, and they had the models, right? And the model predicted certain things, let's say. I don't know. Let's say the model predicted a round disk with a ball in the middle, which is the planet, and then in the center you have the star. So they got the ALMA observations, and they actually realized that the models were very wrong, right? So they actually, what you see is not a very round and perfect disk. It's actually, you have some sort of, they call it the horseshoe. So you have some sort of a horseshoe, let's say, where you actually have a higher density of gas and dust where the planet is forming, actually, which intuitively actually makes more sense, right? Because if you have an homogeneous stuff, then you're never going to form a planet, because you need actually clumps, or you need to have higher density stuff. So then they have to sort of remake the models, and they had to think about it. And they actually, now they sort of makes more sense, and they have better models that they can predict what's going to happen to these. And they actually want to observe it, because this actually evolves quickly-ish, right? Let's say in a few years, you can see the evolution. It's not like normal astronomical stuff that evolves in a million years, right? So they want to test these things in a few years again with ALMA. And all these things is actually what makes us like scientists to be sort of curious about these things and excited, right? Because you always think that you can predict things, and then you realize that actually, no, you need to think more about it, and you need to understand better, and you need more observations. And this is why ALMA is so amazing, because it's sort of changing the way we think in a way.
Nice. Yeah, that's the mantra of astronomers, isn't it? Always more observations.
Yeah, exactly. Definitely.
So can you, what's your like sort of typical day up at ALMA? Like, could you just maybe talk us through what you have to do, what your responsibilities are at the telescope?
Sure. Yeah. So right now I my shift, I'm a night shift, and the night shift is mainly observations, right? So I'm doing observations. So my shift starts at 10 in the evening, and then we have an overlap with the day astronomers. So for an hour, so in this hour, they told me what they've done, and they sort of give me like a plan of what do we need to do for the night.
Okay.
So we mainly have, let's say, the plan of integrating new antennas and doing what we call early science, which is observing, really observing targets, right? So we have this plan, and then they leave at 11, and there's normally two astronomers, so it's me and another astronomer that I stayed the whole night up
Okay.
to 7 in the morning. So we observe the
Okay.
whole, yeah, so from sort of 10 to 7 in the morning, and you just go through the, there's even like a wiki page that has the top priorities of what things you need to do. So
Okay.
you just go through the top priorities and the observations and what you need to do, and try to, so there's a whole process, right? There's a lot of software involved that you have to sort of, let's say that every time you have to observe something, you have a whole sort of a schedule of what target it is, what calibration do you have to do, what I don't know, other, let's say, because every time you calibrate, you have to observe different targets, like flux calibration and phase calibration, or position calibration, let's say. So you have to like check that everything is fine, and then run the observation, and then you leave it running, and while it's running, you can just, like, I don't know, go and get a coffee or chat with the astronomer, or or like,
Okay.
yeah, make sure that the next one is ready and all these things. And I mean, if it runs smoothly, then it's perfect, right? Sometimes it doesn't run as smoothly as you wish. So it's really cool because you have a whole like team of engineers and software people, and everyone like sort of next to you or behind you, or in their offices. But if something crashes, like if the correlator crashes or something, you just call someone, and they come and they try to fix it, and then you'd run again and all these things. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. So, I mean, for example, if you're observing something, is it literally the case of typing in the command and then 30 telescopes will move at the same time to sort of observe something in the sky?
Sort of. It's called, so
Oh.
every observation is called, they has a scheduling block. That's how it's called. So
Okay.
the scheduling block has the coordinates and has how much time does like the antennas have to stay in these coordinates, and then they have to move to a calibrator, and then they have to go back and all these things. So the scheduling blocks has everything. It's like a script, let's say. So you run the script.
Yeah, because I mean, I know that I mean this is it's a completely different process to sort of optical telescopes where, well, obviously they don't work as an array for starters, and then you get a more probably more visual feedback as to what you're looking at, as opposed to with radio or millimeter waves where you collect the data first and then you have to sort of process it and reduce it until you get something that looks like a picture, really.
Right, so yeah, every time you run a script or the scheduling block, we have some sort of a very, very quick sort of way to see the data that we just got. So you, it's like a very broad data reduction script, and you do that, and you check if it was observed fine, sort of, because
Okay.
sometimes you don't know if you had a jump in the, I don't know, in the flux, or something went wrong. So you just check re very briefly, and then if it's fine, you just let it go. Yeah.
So now, as a question, as our guest, Jod Bhaiti, I suppose, is there anything you particularly miss about Manchester?
I do miss Manchester a lot.
And of course,
I
the
mean, ALMA is
Jodcast.
awesome. It's an awesome project. And I'm really happy to be working at ALMA and ARISO as well. But I mean, I don't know, it's a different country, and I like Chile as well, and I like Chileans, but I do miss Manchester a lot. I miss the Jodcast, and I don't know, I miss a lot of things. I yeah.
We haven't really mentioned it, but Manchester plays a fair role in ALMA business as well, because Manchester is what's called an ARC, an ALMA Regional Centre. So could you just say a couple of words about what that involves?
Yeah, sure. It's actually pretty important because it's sort of the node in Europe, or like one of the nodes in Europe, which is pretty important. So what the Manchester people do in the ARC node is sort of, they actually go through all the data that we just took, and they sort of analyze they have different roles, right? But some of the roles are to give back the data to the PI, to the astronomer that sort of wanted to get the observation. Sometimes they just give us some tests that they want to like take ALMA to the extremes, right? Like try to do things that no one taught or sort of what to, like how to improve observations, how to improve calibration, how to improve the data. And they do a lot of sort of tutorials with the general astronomers, how to reduce the data and like the capabilities of ALMA and to promote ALMA, let's say. So there's this is a very super like important job as well. Yeah. I like we all have contact with all the ARC nodes and they have a meeting every like once a month. There's a meeting with every ARC people and like to make sure that we're all on the same page and what are we doing. And
great. Well, that was all really, really interesting, Liz. Thanks a lot for being our guest JodBite interviewee this month. I hope it wasn't too weird being on the other side of the microphone, as it were.
It was a little bit. No, but it's pretty cool. No, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks a lot. All right. Take care, Liz.
Take care. Thank you.